It's a marathon, not a sprint, right? You've got to be in it for the long haul, and you have to have a company that's going to support you on the long haul, right? Because you don't get a lot of quick wins, right? You don't get a lot of quick yeses and nos. It's the ramp up time. It takes a while, and then you start getting the wins, and it pays off. And the other thing, one of the other lessons that kind of hit me over the head was there's a verse that says, it's like servant leadership. You hear this buzzword in the business world, servant leadership.
You're listening to The Isaac Falez Show, a podcast that inspires high performers to reach new heights and be better than their best. My name is Isaac, and I'm best known for my performance coaching, elevating elite athletes and entrepreneurs to unlock their full potential. On this podcast, I sit down and share vulnerable stories on my journey, lessons that I've learned, and I bring on high performers as guests to unlock new insights and share authentic conversations about what winning really looks like. Let's dive into today's episode. Welcome everyone to today's episode on the Isaac Falez Show. Remember that with these interview series, we're bringing on people that are authentic, they are genuine, and they are true to their higher sense of purpose. We want to bring on people that are authentic, that bring to light the aspects of the good and the bad, the struggles of personal development, and what it really means to succeed in the business world. Not the success that we see online of the fancy and the flashy things, but the true success that we wake up every morning feeling fulfilled, feeling that we make a difference in the world, and always prioritizing impact over profits. It's the kinds of people that make the world a better place. They do the right thing and they're rewarded for it. And we want to highlight those. Even if we don't start in the best places, the journey is the beautiful craft of making us into the person we were meant to be. And the lessons that we learn through discomfort are so important, which is why I want to bring on people that, again, bring this kind of energy and have these conversations so you can change your life in the best way, so you can take your life to the next level, whether that's your personal life or your business life. I want to help you succeed, and I want to bring on the best people to help you do so. So without further ado, let me bring on today's guest, Carl. Carl, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Isaac. Gosh, had I known that your intro, I could have gotten you to write the foreword for my book. That was like, you nailed it, man. Completely.
I love it, man. I know I love these kinds of conversations because, to be quite frank, there's a lot of information out on the internet. We live in the attention currency, and sometimes, you know, there's just that information that isn't the greatest. It's pushing people down these paths that it might be nice for a while. They might find success for a while. But when you're building a life of true value and meaning, it's not a short-term play. And so I think, obviously, to get started, I would love for the people just to get to know more about you, what you're doing in the world. So just sharing a little bit about yourself would be fantastic.
Yeah, it's been a long run for me. I'm a little bit older than you, right? I mean, I've lived life. And if I knew the things I knew today when I was your age, I would have done things differently, right? And so I think you're asking all the right questions. If I look back upon my life and I look at the things that I was thinking about in my early 20s that seemed appealing to me. And when I look back on my life, now that I've lived, you know, a good portion of it, and I think about what really mattered, it's not the money. It's not the things I bought. It's not, you know, it's not the stuff at all. It's really the people and the relationships in my life and our shared experiences together, right? And starting at the home, right? Those who are closest to me. And then moving beyond that into my closest friendships, people in the community, people I've done stuff with for 20 plus years. And then, you know, beyond that, people in the business world. The business world doesn't have to be all business, right? It's the way I've done things, because I've integrated like ministry with business, you know, and we'll get into some of this as we talk, I'm sure. But I, you know, one of my callings in life was to launch these workplace ministries. I had a hard cut over at the age of 24, where I went from being a complete atheist to being a born again Christian. And that changed my perspective on the world. I went from being self-centered to being other-centered. And when you're other-centered, what happens is things actually turn out better for you when you're not focused on yourself. And so by doing these types of meaningful things in my work life, I built relationships that have meaning. They're just not transactional relations. The relations where, you know, when somebody comes to you and their kid's in the hospital, their kid could die, and they're calling you and they're saying, you know, would you please pray for my child? That's a real relationship, right? I mean, you know, that's not like a transactional, you know, what can you do for me today? What money can I make from you? That's like, oh man, dude, you know, you want to cry a little bit. Let's talk about this. Absolutely. I'll pray for your kid. And then to celebrate when those prayers are answered, it's nothing like that, man. That's really living life.
You know, I think it's interesting because there's always been a transactional side to the world, but I think it's been less accessible before than it is now. And so I think a lot of people are struggling with this idea of transactional relationships, especially the younger, you know, generation, I think, is growing up with being more transactional, whether that's through relationships or whether that's through networking. You know, it's all about getting these connections, but it's not necessarily about building relationships. And I think that the long-term players in these kinds of games are the ones that build those relationships. I think your journey back to faith highlights something that's bigger in a lot of people's journeys, where it's when we believe that we are here to serve others, regardless of the spiritual capacity that we have for religion or against religion, I think that's where things start to change. Because the gratitude that I think abundance is built out of has to start within, but it has to be focused outwards. And so there's this line that I've always loved, and it's, you have to be selfish to be selfless. And I think it's the idea of, we have to make sure that we're taking care of ourselves, because when we take care of ourselves, we can then shift our focus to take care of the world. And I think that, again, starting within, right, you start with yourself, you start with cleaning your house and getting your house in order. And then you really spread to, how can I impact lives? And so I think that while maybe the journey that got you to being a Christian again might not be the most ideal in a theological sense, I think that sometimes it's hard for us to appreciate things until we've given them up, and then we have to fight back for them as well.
Well, I never had it. Like, I was born into
it.
You were
always, okay, got you.
I was an atheist. I was the furthest thing. I didn't even know anything about God. It wasn't even in the picture. And it really took, you know, kind of that lightning bolt to wake me up. But faith or no faith, I'm talking to just your average person going through life, right? Talk about transactional versus relational. So if you think about my dating life back prior to making that change in my life, it was transactional. I wanted to know what I could get from a woman, right? I'd go out with her with the goal of getting something. And once I got it, like, all right, I got it. You know, that's a transaction, and it's empty. You're empty at the end of that. And then, you know, when I finally came to the point where I changed my ways and I wasn't going to do that anymore, then it was relational. And then anybody I met who was transactional with me, if I met a woman who just wanted that transaction, I walked away. I didn't want it. And my wife, the woman I've been married to for 29 years, when I met her, she was the first one not to push me to be like that. And so, you know what? I spent 3 years getting to know her. That was a relationship, right? It took faith for me to be able to make that change, but maybe you're just looking for a more fulfilled life, and relationships versus transactions is a way to get there. And so when I met my wife, because we didn't jump in the bed together, I actually got to know her. And you know what? I realized, and we were friends more than anything. I realized, you know what? I can't do without this friendship. And so I married her. And then we were together, you know, and yeah, we've had five kids now. So, you know, certainly transacted, but it was based on a relationship. And I know that's kind of maybe too much information, but that takes it down to the core of what it means to develop a relationship. And now we've got, you know, a foundation to build a life on together, a family on together, and we're still together. Whereas when we've gone through some hard things, you know, it's not like my life is devoid of trouble and trials and challenges. I mean, I have as many troubles and challenges as the next guy, but because we you know, built that foundation together and we built that relationship, our relationship is rooted in our shared faith. You know, we've got that bedrock that, you know, the storms may blow and you know, we're challenged in various ways, but we're still together.
Well, I think it's even like, I know you mentioned like it might be too much, but to be honest, I think nowadays everything's so superficial and shallow that going deep is really what's needed to absolve some of the pain and suffering that we cause unnecessarily because we refuse to, you know, be tied down to these important things. But I think you look at like the long-term play, and even looking at, I studied a lot of Greek mythology just because it was fascinating to me. And you look at the story of like Odysseus and how him and his wife had the relationship based on the olive tree that was that grew around one of the bedposts, so the tree could never be moved. The marriage bed was always solidified. And I think that, you know, all of us have our problems. We're all going to have our troubles. That's part of life. And I think that's one of the beautiful parts of life. I think problems are great opportunities for us to learn from. But it's kind of not all problems are made equal, and not all problems are going to lead to the same outcomes. And so I think it's also like, do we pick the struggles that we choose? You know, being single is hard. Being married is also hard. There's no easy route, but one of them is going to lead to different routes than the other. And so I think it's also the law of choices of everything's going to have an opportunity cost. And it's kind of, if we're not aware of what we want to do with our lives and who we want to be helping, we're only just wasting time by the decisions that we make. And I feel like we just have to know where we're going and where we've been to really be intentional with both our time and our energy.
Agreed. Yeah, I couldn't have said it better. And it's not just, you know, the marriage relationship and you know, men and women and stuff. It has to do with business as well. And so if you look at, you know, your average kid coming out of college or out of high school and they take a sales job and they're selling, you know, a lot of those sales, they're transactional sales. And so I actually get called in to do training for businesses on the type of selling that I've done. And so the type of, I was the first person to get a business development position in a professional services organization. So back, this was 26 years ago. I was hired to be the first business development professional at PricewaterhouseCoopers. And when I got hired, there were two firms merging together, Coopers and Lybrand and Pricewaterhouse, two of the biggest accounting firms in the world were coming together, and they needed to have a united front to the marketplace, which meant they needed somebody to go sell their services in the marketplace. And I'm married to an auditor, an accountant. And so I know that audits are pretty boring. Like, nobody wants to buy a freaking audit. You know, like, if you're a successful company, you're going to need an audit, but you don't want anybody selling you an audit. And so I had to figure out, how can I make audits sexy? And it wasn't by selling audits. It was by developing relationships. And so this goes through my whole methodology of how I approach business my entire life. I realized that our firm did the accounting work for some of the biggest companies in the world, as well as venture funds, most of the venture funds in the world. What does every startup need? They need customers and they need investors. And so I realized that I was sitting on top of that whole relationship, 165,000 employees, you know, in 155 countries. It was a huge firm. And I was one email or phone call away from every one of those big companies. And so I made it my business to help people who were starting out get connected to companies I could buy from them and investors who can invest in them. And because I did that, people loved me. They, you know, I was helpful to them. And because I was helpful to them, when their company grew and one of their investors says, oh, we need audited financial statements, who do you think they called? Me, right? And so then I got hired to do the same thing at one of the world's most prestigious law firms in the world, Cooley. And when I joined the firm had $310 million in annual revenue. When I left the firm 20 years later, it had over $2 billion in annual revenue. The way we did that was by developing relationships, by doing the same thing. There's no magic there. It's a longer sales cycle, but all those sales were built on relationships. And those people were my friends. And so I got to know them. I got to know their businesses. I helped them and I delivered value to them. And over the course of their, you know, the life of their business or businesses, they spent millions and millions of dollars with my firm. And so that's the kind of the long-term view that I've taken in life, in business, and in relationships.
Well, I think that's like, even with the business terms, like that's what LTV is, right? Like, relationships focus on the lifetime value. Lifetime value isn't just trying to, you know, make someone buy from you and then never talk to them again. Lifetime value requires more work. And I think the relationships are such a win-win. But the reason they're so hard is because they take up a lot more time and energy. And oftentimes, like, they're going to require you to sacrifice your time and your energy to make them grow before they might yield anything, as the same as growing any crops or growing a tree. And so I think that, you know, sometimes it's the message that we have to continue pushing into the world that's like, the answers and the results that you want, they're on the other side of growth. But the growth that you choose kind of depends the kind of, you know, answers and results you're going to get, because there's growth that's short term and there's growth that's long term. And I think that, I mean, looking back, I don't think there's any better thing than to say, I made great relationships with great people, and we changed the world because of it. Because you have inputs that are good and authentic, and you have outputs that are also good and authentic because they match the inputs. And so I would also say that I am curious to something about you. When you kind of started shifting from transactional to more of a relationship-based sense, what were some of the struggles that you had with building relationships?
Well, you know, I didn't really struggle with it. So what I did was when I became a believer, and I have to tie it back to that because it took that to change my focus. I was in business school, and I was studying. I had this course that I loved. It was called Power, Persuasion, and Ethics. And the power and persuasion part was fascinating. We studied Machiavelli, right? I mean, stuff was fascinating. And then when it came to ethics, we touched on the Bible. And it was right around the time where I had just become a believer. I'm like, okay, this fits in. This fits in here somewhere. And I had to figure out, I had an academic setting to figure out like where it fits in. And so when I got out into the business world, I started thinking about all the things I'd learned in reading the Bible, you know, that second year of graduate school, and some of the things that I read, that, you know, and I had to think about how do these apply? Like the golden rule, right? This is a universal rule, whether you're a believer or not, right? Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. That's just a simple rule to live by, right? And so if I'm going to do to somebody else what I would have them do to me, I have to think about, okay, what would I want in that situation? And so it's a marathon, not a sprint, right? You've got to be in it for the long haul, and you have to have a company that's going to support you on the long haul, right? Because you don't get a lot of quick wins, right? You don't get a lot of quick yeses and nos. It's the ramp up time. It takes a while, and then you start getting the wins, and it pays off. And the other thing, one of the other lessons that kind of hit me over the head was there's a verse that says, It's like servant leadership. You hear this buzzword in the business world, servant leadership. Well, the ultimate servant leader was Jesus. And he said, he who wishes to be first must be last and servant of all. I'm like, oh, wow. that's deep. Like, what does that look like? And then I had to think back to my Army officer training. And when I was an Army officer, I was a second lieutenant. And when we would eat a meal, you know, you have 40 guys in a platoon. And when there's a limited amount of food, and when you feed the unit, as the officer, you don't eat first, you eat last to make sure all your soldiers are fed before you, and you get what's left over, right? That's who he wishes to be first must be last and servant of all. And so I had to think about that in the business world, right? If I'm going to be last and servant of all, if I have a 17-person team that I'm leading, what does that look like? It doesn't mean that I hog all the attention and I take the credit for stuff. I support my team. I give them credit for what they've done. And you know what? Ultimately, it makes me more successful and me shine because I'm serving my team. And so I've had to try to go against human nature my whole life to try to make that work.
Of course. So I am curious because I find that with a lot of, you know, people in the business world and entrepreneurs, they have an interesting relationship with the term balance. So I'm curious what the word balance means to you.
Yeah. So that, and that's where you have to set your priorities, right? So you have to know what's most important in your life and what that order is. So for me, my faith is number one. Two, my family. Number three, my health and fitness. And number four, my career and everything else after that. And so, you know, that's hard, right? In order to do that, what does that look like, right? People say, I don't have time to work out, or I don't have time to read the Bible or pray or whatever it is. You know, spend time with my wife, or, you know, whatever your other priorities, they say, you know, I'm too busy. I'm a busy guy. If you followed me around, I would drive most people, you know, I'd wear them out, right? Because I'm going. But what does that mean? That means I get up really freaking early. You know, and I don't even want to tell you how early it is. You'd think I was a crazy man, but I get up well, most of the world is sleeping.
Let me guess, 3:30.
Dude, you don't even want to know. I don't set an alarm. I just wake up and I go, right? And so I was up earlier than that today. And so, normally I'm up at not because I want to be, I really would like to sleep to 4, but I was up at 2:30 this morning because I had stuff to do. right? I was in bed. I was getting ready for bed at 8:30. I was in bed asleep by 9, right? But you know what? I'm not out partying. I'm not out doing stuff that other people are doing. I'm going to bed, and then I wake up when I get. I never set an alarm. I don't have to. I always wake up. And so I'm up and I'm doing all the things that I want to knock out and get done early in the morning. My wife didn't get up until 5 o'clock. So I had a good couple, 2.5 hours before she got up to get my own stuff done. And then we got our stuff done at 6. And then I went to the gym, right? And so I spent time with my wife. We spent time doing our Bible study, prayer time, and other things we do. And then I went to the gym. And then after that, I started my work day. And I had already gotten, it's part of that army training, right? Like we're out getting stuff done while the rest of the world's sleeping. And you know what? You feel good about that. I feel great knowing that I got a lot of my little stuff done, a lot of stuff that would bore the crap out of you, just little things I have to get done, right? Everybody's got personal little stuff they need to do, right? I knock that stuff out while everybody's asleep. And then I get into the things that are so important to me. And I, you know, so, you know, once my faith was taken care of, my family was taken care of, my health was taken care of. And then I started to work, and I got to work the same time as everybody else. So you just have to set your priorities, and it takes discipline to do that. Not everybody's going to do that. Like I wasn't keeping a schedule like this when I was younger. I was staying up till 2 a.m. just like anybody else. But you know what? Now I'm getting up then, and you know, I'm living better today.
It's funny. No, I wake up at 5 a.m. I don't know if you've read the book, but a 5 a.m. Club by Robin Sharma. I've just been reading it recently, but I've been getting up at 5 for probably last 2 years, maybe 5:30-ish before, but I love the morning. It's so peaceful. It's quiet. It's calm. And I just feel like I can get so much done. I am curious though, because most people that I've meet that wake up early, they tend to work on the more important things first and then leave the other stuff for later. So I'm curious if you've ever tried that, or if you've always just kind of stuck with the system of like getting the personal out of the way first.
You know what? I don't control when I wake up. And so if I wake up extra early, like I did today, it's just like, I've got even more time, right? I tried to sleep more. My mind was awake and ready to go. I was so ready to go. I mean, so I do weird stuff. Like I sit in a infrared sauna in the morning for half an hour. You know, it's really good for your health. And I used to listen to podcasts when I do that, but I don't now. I like, you know, this is going to sound weird to you, but I take that time to get quiet in my own mind. I pray and I try to listen. You know, it's amazing what you can hear when you listen. And I believe I hear from God, you know, and I have a notepad and I write stuff down. Some of my best revelations come where my mind is completely clear. And I, you know, this may seem weird to you. Are you a believer, or is this all sound?
Yeah, I'm a believer. I'm just okay, I'm listening right. to you. Don't worry.
All right. So I say, you know, I say, my Father in heaven, speak, for your servant is listening. And I say it in Jesus' name. And then I'm just quiet and I clear my mind. And you know what? Sometimes things come to me, sometimes they don't. But when they do come to me, when my mind is completely clear, I haven't gotten into the busyness of the day. It's amazing how things will come to me. And I'm not like a prophet that gets visions and says sometimes, but those are rare. Normally I get things that pop to my mind that I need to do. And I write those down in a tablet before my mind gets busy with the clutter of the day. And I write those things down and I have to go back to my notebook. And I'm like, oh yeah, these are things that I heard when my mind was clear, when I was trying to listen for the voice of God. And it's amazing how when you follow up on those things, those were like really important things to do that had I not in the still of the morning when there's not a noise in the house, it's like nobody's awake. I'm sitting in there 140 degrees and sweating, you know, and I'm hearing things that I need to do, whether or not it's something that's coming from my own brain or, you know, the Holy Spirit's talking to me. I can't tell you. I'm not that, you know, that holy that I can tell you, you know, yeah, that's the voice of God. I, you know, sometimes I think it is, but sometimes it's just the clarity of thought that you have at that time in the morning.
You know, I definitely think that there's there's something that's just inexplicable at the morning. Like anytime I wake up, you know, I just feel more alive, you know, because you don't have the sunlight yet. You just like, you have that peace and quiet. And I know that more research nowadays, I know the infrared has had a lot of research recently about all the benefits, but they've created these things called I think they're sound deprivation ticks. And they're basically like, I don't know if you've heard of them, but you float in like water. Like, it's barely any water. And they're like vacuums. So there's no sound at all. So it's completely still and quiet. And I've heard really good research on those. I just find it fascinating because I think a lot of us, you know, try with the information first, like at the podcast or the books. But then the stillness of the mind, I think, is so beautiful. I do two types of meditation. I do mindfulness and visualization. So I do mindfulness in the morning where I try to clear my head and just kind of let thoughts flow naturally. I'm not trying to control anything, just kind of accepting and just being in the present. And then at night, I try to do visualization. And it's very funny because the way I do the visualization is like, I close my eyes, I get into like the moment, and I have like this eye, like this almost like eye that's like a flaming big eye, like an ever-seeing eye. And I just like zooms into it. And then I kind of see, like, I just start trying to visualize things. So I think that those conversations with ourselves, they're not as common as they used to be for most people, but I think it is very freeing. And I also, I think the community aspect, especially in the faith side of things, is beautiful. So for example, I mean, today's Friday, we're recording this on a Friday. I go to a men's Bible study or a men's Bible group Friday mornings at 6:30. And, you know, just sitting there with a nice black cup of coffee and just listening to guys that are, you know, 25, to guys that are 72, just talking about life, talking about experiences. For example, now we're working through this book. It was a professor writing to his daughter, who's a college student, about surviving. It's called Surviving Religion 101. And so it's just about, you know, how you keep your faith through the college years. And so it's just fascinating listening to people from like all different experiences come together to talk about these topics. So I think that just the power in that community, and again, going back to the relationships, like, I don't think there's anything that can be stressed more than just being who you are and building authentic relationships because of those things as well.
Yeah. I mean, when I think about people that I like to do stuff with, right? Like, so a lot of the business that I do is built around stuff that I find to be fun, right? I like to go, I live on Lake Travis, and I love to go out on a boat on Lake Travis. I mean, I can't think of a more fun thing to do on a really nice day than to go out on a boat. And so I, during COVID, when people really weren't doing a lot of stuff, I did these things called nautical networking events. And I just started inviting, because the guidance at the time was 10 people outside, you know, and you know, no larger than 10. And whether or not any of that stuff was made sense or not, you know, whatever. I'm not here to judge, you know, but that was the guidance. So I didn't want to be seen as like some crazy guy who was getting together huge groups of people. So I'd get 10 people on a boat and we would go out on the lake. And, you know, it's just such a peaceful, relaxing environment. And people are having like glasses of wine and beers and stuff. And you know what? Out on the lake, a couple drinks in, COVID disappeared. Like, everybody forgot about it. Nobody's wearing masks. I mean, it's, and you pull off into a cove and you just casually have everybody introduce themselves to each other. And, you know, after like 2-3 hours out on the lake, everybody's friends, like people that didn't even know each other before they got out there, they now have these relationships. And then I'd ask everybody to get up like halfway through, hey, why don't everybody switch seats so you get to know other people, right? And so then you get to know different people on the boat. And by the end of that boat trip, man, you've got like real relationships. Like, people have had a fun experience together. And if I look at the relationships that were formed in Austin, Texas, that's where I live, some of the best business relationships in this city were formed on that boat, me taking people out, just enjoying, it didn't even look like a business event. It was just a bunch of people having fun together. And you know what, based on those relationships that were developed, businesses come out of it. I mean, real business. And it's kind of cool, right? And my whole life has been like that. I try to turn stuff that I think would be fun into business. And that's the approach I've taken most of my career.
I love it. I think that, well, there's a lot of cultures that talk about like the importance of relationships. Like, I think that I think in Switzerland, I think they have a custom where you have to talk like 10, 20 minutes of just like chit chat before you talk business. And I think that there's a lot of other cultures where like, and again, even just I think in business in general, like I think a lot of people, especially like from the outside looking in, they get it wrong and they just think like, oh, you know, you go to dinner, you make the deal and then it's all done, like said and good. It's like, no, you just go to dinner and you have a conversation with another person. And then, you know, that person and you build trust and rapport because of authentic connection. And from there, they're the person you want to do business with. It's, you know, it's a simple process, yet it's more complicated because it requires you to be vulnerable, requires you to open up. So I think there's, you know, there's obviously a lot of skills in relationship building, but I think that at the end of the day, there's nothing more fulfilling than doing those kinds of things. And so for you, I would ask, you know, how do you have maybe different levels of friendships to say, or do you kind of view your friends at equal levels? What's your kind of mentality around that for you?
Yeah, so I do this. I get called on to do business development training, and I categorize these people. It's I had to come up with classifications, you know. So you have your like core group of people that you talk to weekly, and then you've got your other group of people that you touch base with like every other month or quarterly, right? And then you've got your And I've got names for all these in the training that I do. Then you've got the group of people that are part of your circle. Like we're the circle of people that you associate with and organizations that you belong to and go to that you don't really have to set up lunches and meetings with. I mean, you're just going to see these people because you're running the same circles, right? And so those are different tiers. And then there's everybody else, right? I mean, if you've been around a while like me and you've got tens of thousands of connections on LinkedIn, you look at, I've got, I don't know what it is, like 16,500 LinkedIn connections. And cause I usually don't accept, you know, invitations if I don't know somebody or don't have a reason to know somebody. And so you can't possibly have a coffee or a lunch or a meeting with that many people. And so the way that, and that's like everybody else. And so everybody else I keep in touch with through engagement on social media. That everybody else, you know, they're not part of the core group. There's like the core group of people that are part of my inner circle that I talk with regularly. They're my friends, right? Yes, business comes out of those relationships, but I actually care about those people, right? And so, yeah, I do have those tiers, and they're not locked in stone. They can move, right? Like somebody may be part of your inner circle today that's not going to be part of your inner circle tomorrow because life changes and circumstances changes and so on and so forth. People move, people get married, people die. I mean, things happen. And so you have to remain flexible, but you can't be everybody's best friend. So I think it's important to really, you know, take inventory of who's in your inner circle. You become like the people you hang out with. You know, that's something, Isaac, that is really important to think about because you're a thoughtful guy, right? You want to live a life on purpose, I can tell, right? And so if you want to live a life on purpose, if you're hanging out with people who are not living the way you aspire to live, they're gonna drag you down, right? If I want to be a guy who's faithful to my wife, who's an upstanding member of the business community, it doesn't behoove me to hang out with people who are running around cheating on their wives, doing shady business deals, right? Like I don't need those people in my inner circle. In fact, I disconnect with those people. Like I don't even want to be associated with those people. I want to be associated with people I aspire to be like. And so I look to get close to people who are living where I want to live because I'm not perfect, right? I mean, I can always do better. I'm always striving to do better.
I think striving to do better has been a philosophy adopted, or it's been an ideal adopted by many philosophies. And I just think that the overall consistent movement towards improvement is such a powerful force for really enacting change in one's life. And you know, you said it very well. To me, the relationships and the people that we hold close, it says a lot about us, but even more than the reputation of who we are, it also speaks to the character inside of us. Because, you know, I'm a big believer in the philosophy of Stoicism, and Seneca talked about this idea, and Marcus Aurelius touched on it too, that, you know, we guard our possessions and our belongings with intent, right? We lock our cars, we lock our houses, and we make sure that our belongings are well protected. But But how many of us spend that kind of time and care when it comes to our mind? Our walls are down and we just let any idea or thing influence how we think or move about the world. But our mind is 10, 100 times more valued than any possessions that we have. So it has to be more secured and protected. And so I think, you know, especially in my younger years, I definitely had, I wouldn't say that I struggled with it, but I would definitely say that I wasn't as ruthless or as intentional with those kinds of relationships as, you know, as I've learned from, you know, guidance like yours and other people who understand what it's like to have good relationships and then understand what it's like to have great relationships. And so I think that when you're talking about self-improvement, you're always talking about good is good, but you can always go for better. You can always go for greater. And I think that there's, you know, greater in the long-term view and there's greater in the short-term view. And I think that the players in the game that do the best in terms of living a good life, they're always long-term players. They're never looking for the shortcuts in life. They know that the good things take time. They take humility. They take lessons. And I think that the beautiful thing about the journey is the journey. And I think that, you know, for me as a younger individual, I know that I have struggled very much so with the ideals of patience, with the ideals of waiting your time, because when you want things out of life, it's hard to accept that you have to wait for those things when you feel like you can get those things. But the truth is that there's a beauty in my youth. There's a beauty in the process. And I think over the past couple of months, patience has become such a valuable thing to me. And I think that these kinds of conversations that we're having, whether if we were closer in age or not, are always going to be valuable, because I believe that at any level, there's always three levels of relationships people can have in terms of distance. And it's, you know, to me, it's the mentor, it's the peer, and it's the mentee, right? Someone we're learning from, someone we're talking with about all these ideas, and someone that we're teaching all this to. And I just think that those kinds of different ways of sharing information and having conversation really allow us to live the good life.
I agree. And you know what, as you talk about those levels, you know, you might think of, you know, a young person looking to an old person to get that wisdom, but it doesn't always work that way. Right now as somebody who's not exactly the young person, I have, you know, with 5 kids, sometimes you can learn from your kids, right? You know, it's amazing how you can get wisdom from younger people too. It's not always the inverse. And so I think it's important as one gets older, not to go and say, you know, what does this young guy know? Because it's not like that. Sometimes young people come to you with wisdom that's well beyond the stuff that you knew. And so I learned stuff from my kids and from my kids' friends. And so you got to keep an open mind. There's always ways to improve. And you were talking about the mind. That's a really, really important one. And I touched on that in my book, because it took me years to get there, because so many people, they feel like they can't control what goes on in their mind. And what I say is, nobody else controls what goes on in your mind. There's nobody else that's going to control what goes on in your mind. And so most people think that they don't have any control. Right. And what goes on in your mind controls what comes out of your mouth. And what comes out of your mouth actually controls what happens in your life. I mean, it's amazing how that works. And so, you know, when I talk about the mind, if you feast on negative stuff, if you open up Twitter, now called X, every day, and you look at people hurting each other every day, or you feed on a constant diet of pornography, and you're just filling your mind with filth, guess what? You're poisoning your mind. You're programming your mind to think about violence, hatred, smut, and filth, and you know, transactional sex, and it's just it's not a good place to be. And so that's the internet. You know, if you get yourself sucked into the internet, or that, you know, maybe not as debased as this stuff. Maybe you're a young woman and you're looking at Instagram photos or TikToks, and you're seeing the most attractive women in the world who are using filters and everything else to look good. You know, you're looking at the most beautiful women in the world, and then you're getting a negative, like, identity because you don't look like that. Well, you know what, you're setting yourself up for failure. So shut that crap off and fill your mind with truth, right? So when you when you fill your mind with positive thoughts and truth. And so for me, it's God's word, right? Like I spend a lot of time going through, my wife and I have several lists of God's promises in the Bible. We go through and we claim those promises out loud. That may seem silly, but you know what? There's a certain power to putting things that you believe into words that you speak out loud. Ever since we started doing that, our life has changed. And you know what? If you do that consistently enough, you start to memorize those words. And so when somebody says something to you that's negative or is a lie, you know what? You can replace that thought with something that's true. And so when you have that stored up in your mind and in your heart to bring to memory like that and to repeat in your mind and ultimately out your mouth, there's power in that. And it may seem like a crazy concept to some of the people who are watching or listening, but I'm telling you, I've lived this and it works. And so there's a whole science behind the spoken word. I don't know if you've looked at, and I'm not an expert in this, but the whole idea of quantum physics and you know, speaking words. I look at people
my age. The concept of a manifestation, right?
It does it. My wife is deep into this and she travels with people who are into this stuff. So I catch it. I've read some of it. So I understand it on the periphery and I understand it well enough to practice it. For example, if you're constantly saying, I don't even like to say these words, but I'm going to say them for illustration purposes. I'm ugly. I'm a loser. You know, I'm old. You know, I look at people that talk about being old and overweight and ugly. I look at the way they age. You know, sure enough, they become old, ugly, and overweight because they're speaking that garbage onto themselves. I don't talk like that. I'm constantly improving myself, Isaac. I'm getting better every year. I'm not getting younger chronologically, but in my, you know, if you look at the way I conduct myself, you know, in addition to all those things I said, I work out, do cardio every morning. When I'm working, when I'm not sitting here on a podcast, I'm walking on a treadmill desk. I walk 10 miles a day and then I go to the gym at night, right? I'm staying active. I'm more active than most guys half my age. And it was as a result of the positive things that come out of my mouth, I look 20 years younger than I am. So people tell me. And so, you know, and not only do I look it, I feel it, right? I'm living it. I've got the energy I've got more energy now than I had when I was in my early 20s because of all the things I've learned and put into practice over the years.
So many ideas popping through my head. I think that even just starting out, like there's this idea that, you know, our feelings lead to our thoughts lead to our actions, and our actions lead to our reality. But even going past and just starting with the feelings, like, again, another idea the Stoics had was we choose how to feel about a thing, right? You know, we can either be someone that things happen to or someone that makes things happen, and choosing which way we want to feel, right? The victim mindset or the change mindset, the doer mindset, that's our source of power, right? Because victims get power from accepting that things aren't their, like, it's not their fault. And doers get their power from accepting that it is their responsibility to change things. And I think that one thing you also touched on was really that idea that I think is also very prominent in the Bible, which is comparison is the thief of joy. Like all of us, and the Japanese also said this, the ikigai, which was our reason for being, is so unique that it only applies to one person. Like God has a predestined path for each one of us. Regardless if you believe in God or not, we all have a predestined path of one thing that we're going to be great at, and that's a whole encompassing life. Right, it takes every fiber of our being to live that way. And so I think that these kinds of ideas, like, they're so important because the sooner we can realize them, the sooner we can move forward with it. And I think to another point that you mentioned with the fitness, I think that just having the health, both the mental and the physical, is so important for continuing to live that good life and being in good health and having good thoughts and having great relationships, because you just feel great all the time. And I think to your point about the manifestation, or at least the manifestation, to me, it has the science research, but there's also like a lot of smaller theories that make up, I think, manifestation as a whole. For example, in psychology, they study confirmation bias. So what you continue to look for is what you tend to confirm, because that's what your brain is wired to confirm. So if you look at faults or issues with yourself, Your brain confirms that because it points to all evidence. However, there's evidence of the contrary. If you make change and you seek the change and actually want the change, your brain's going to confirm it because that's the confirmation bias. And so I think also there's an unrealistic expectation if we want to be a better person, if we don't believe we can be a better person. Like, you have to believe something for it to be true before it can be true. And belief doesn't replace the work, but it allows you to start the work because you now know where you're actually trying to go. And so I think there's a part that you have to be able to speak it into existence, meaning you have to be able to speak the belief that it is real so you can now go do the work. So I think it's a two-part component, but I think people that work hard but don't believe they can go anything past the work hard, they work hard all their life and live a good life, but it's nothing special. People that believe they can go far and work hard, I think, are the people that also start to learn those lessons that allow them to work smarter and more efficiently, not just be hard workers. Because I think there's not been a person that has had meaningful success, not just inherited success, but meaningful success without working hard. But working hard isn't the only thing, and usually isn't the thing that'll get you to that benchmark that people most say they want, I think.
You've said so many things that have triggered so many thoughts that I don't know if I can get back to them all. Earlier, you used an agricultural analogy, and so much of what happens in life, it builds on that analogy. So, for example, the whole concept of sowing and reaping, right? You reap what you sow, right? If you put a pumpkin seed in the ground, you're gonna get a pumpkin plant. You're not gonna get a green bean plant or an apple plant. You're gonna get pumpkins, right? You got the water, you're gonna have to get sunshine and all that. But you plant one seed and you're gonna reap what you sow. But that reaping comes much later, right? You gotta wait, you gotta be patient. You put that seed in the ground. And that seed for me might be doing a favor for somebody. I'm doing something good for another person. That's my seed. I've helped that person. Even if that person has nothing to give me in return, I've planted that seed. You plant enough of those seeds over time, you're going to get a harvest. The harvest is going to come in. If you're doing bad things to people all the time, bad stuff is going to come back to you because you're planting a bunch of negative seeds. I try not to do that. I try to plant good seeds, and I wait for the harvest. And I'm telling you, the harvest comes back tenfold. That one seed, it doesn't yield one pumpkin. It yields a bunch of pumpkin, right? You know, when you plant one apple seed, you're going to get a bunch of apples on that apple tree, but you got to wait. You plant enough of those seeds, you're going to get a big harvest, right? That's how it works. That's how it works in relationships. And so that was one analogy that you gave. And then the other one, you talked about feelings and actions. You know, your feelings dictate your actions. The interesting thing was when I went to get my MBA, we had a shout out to Joe Pica. He was the director of the MBA program back then. We're still friends to this day at a distance. But I remember him standing up talking about feelings and actions. So many people let their feelings drive their actions. And he talked about having your actions drive your feelings. He flipped it on its head. And I remember thinking about that. I'm like, oh, yeah. So somebody does something to upset me, and I may be upset. And if I act upset and I lash out at that person, that usually doesn't work out well. So there's so many times people say things that upset me, and that's my feeling. But I got to switch it. I got to flip the switch, and I'm not going to act the way I feel. I'm going to act differently than the way I feel. And you know what? When you can change the way you act and not base it on your feelings, you'd be amazed at what happens. And I'll give you an example. I'm not going to name a name. I remember there was a guy. I had helped him. I helped him with his business. I had introduced him to investors. I did everything I was supposed to do. And he didn't hire my firm. He hired another firm. And I was upset, right? That was a normal feeling, right? You help, you do something to help somebody, and you're hoping they hire you, but they don't hire your firm. And I remember the partner that I one of the partners I reported to, he sent me an email. He said, I know you're upset. And it was a Christian guy too. So I had extra reason to be upset with him. So he said, I know you're upset. He goes, don't let him know. Just tuck it away and congratulate him on raising his money and wish him well. And you know what? I did that. It hurt. My feelings were hurt, but I did what he told me to do. It was good mentorship. And the same guy came back And I don't, there was some political reason why he didn't hire my firm. I don't even know what it was. It doesn't matter. He came back to me after he had sold his company and made a whole bunch of money, by the way, came back to me when he was founding his next company. And you know what he did? He said, Carl, I know you wanted me to hire you at my last company and we weren't able to for whatever reason. He goes, but not only do I want to hire you guys for this next company, I want you to be my advisor and I want to give you 10,000 shares in my company. And so I'm like, oh, wow. Like, you know, and sure enough, he went on and he sold that company as well. And I made a little bit of money. It wasn't a lot of money, but you know what? It was a good enough story that I'm sitting here telling it to you some however many years later, probably 10 years later. I'll never forget that lesson, right? Because if I would have acted on my feelings and said, you know, I think that's really a bunch of garbage that you didn't hire my firm after I did all these favors for you, I wouldn't have had the end of that story. I'm sure the story is not over because I'm still friends with this guy and I never let on that I was upset. Maybe he'll know who I'm talking about if he listens to this this broadcast. but that's one story, and that same story has happened 1,000 times in my life, right? Somebody says something, you know, you lose things, you lose a job, you lose this, you lose that. Things happen, right? And you know, when it first happens, you're upset, but then you think about, oh, well, this opens up this opportunity. Like now I now have an opportunity to do this, right? And you change your whole focus and you put a smile on your face and you don't act on those feelings. So I whatever the philosopher was that said that, I beg to differ.
See, here's the thing, because I would agree with you, but I would still go around that same route of thinking, because to me, anything that happens to us, we have to first either decide if we're going to feel a way about it or not feel anything at all about it. But we still have to process the information that comes our way. And so I think the difference is, for example, we lose somebody, right? We might be thinking, or we might be feeling very upset, very sad. And in that moment, we can flip the thinking, we can flip the feeling to, instead of feeling sad, what if we're feeling to get an opportunity to be more grateful for what we have? Or for example, in your case, instead of feeling that you were being betrayed, feel that you were being tested for your patience. And so it's not so much show that our feelings control our actions, because I never would advise that. And I'm completely 100% with you. But I think that when we change, for example, if we change every problem in our business to every opportunity, right? What stands in the way becomes the way, the obstacle is the way. I think that's where the magic really starts happening, because we have to process information, but we don't have to feel any way about how the information affects us, or we can choose how we feel. Because again, like the Stoics talked about, it's in the inner locus of control. You can't tell me how to feel. You can, but you have no power on making that happen, regardless of how much influence or power you have in the world. I, on the other hand, have all the power to process what you're telling me and to feel any type of way about it. And so one of the great examples about this was that Epictetus, who was a slave, but he felt free because in his mind he was free. And so it kind of goes to show that we really have that power, but it does take a lot to cultivate it. And I think on top of that, like you mentioned, a lesson that is so important is that no actions based on feelings ever led to good results. And I think that, you know, understanding how to label, not push down, but label emotions, and then write them off in their place, right? They're feelings. They're not you. They're, you know, it's the body's response to the mind is really where the feelings come from. And we have to make sure we put them in our place, because again, we're the captain of our ship, right? And our ship is sailing in the ocean that is, you know, for us believers, God's land, right? We sail to his winds, right? We're not the ones steering the boat, so to speak. We're just, you know, managing the ship. But I think that even more so, we have to always remember that, again, what are we doing and how are we taking the actions to get where we want to go and impact the lives we want to impact? Because like you mentioned, servant leadership isn't about us. It's about everybody else. And in order to serve everybody else, we have to ask ourselves, how are we, you know, serving the right kinds of values? Because I know that in a book, I think it was Mindset by Carol Dweck, she talks about the different centers, right? You have the self-centered people. You have the friend-centered people, or the family-centered people, or the work-centered people. But to me, I've always loved the idea of the principle-centered people, centered around just ethical grounding things that have existed for thousands of years of just good and true and righteous beliefs.
Have you ever looked at somebody, have you ever seen somebody who like holds everybody in unforgiveness? Like they walk around, they're really miserable looking people, right? They're upset at everybody, and those people they're upset with, they've forgotten about that person. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Like they don't care. Like it's a, so in my faith journey, I've had people describe it, you know, unforgiveness is like drinking poison and hoping the other person dies. Right. It's basically right. And so you walk around and you don't forgive people who have done you wrong. And I don't know. I think it's a lot easier to walk through life without a lot of burdens like that. You know, I mean, there's people that have done me wrong, and I just have to forgive them and leave them to God, because you know they're the ones who are miserable. It's not me. They're not going to make me miserable. Why should I carry that around? Right. And so I did a podcast. I've done two podcasts. One was Faith at Work, and the other one was Rainmaker. So one was about how people integrate their faith at work. And I interviewed some really interesting people. And I remember this one guy I interviewed. I can't remember his name. I shouldn't say his name, but he had a dad who molested him and his brothers as a kid. I mean, it was bad. Not only did he molest him, he beat him. And so one of his brothers is dead, suicide. And the other one, I think, is on drugs. I mean, he's just a freaking mess. And then the guy who I interviewed, he's got this organization called 70 times 7. And you know where that came from, right? You know, Jesus, somebody said, asked Jesus, you know, how many times should I forgive somebody? 7 times? And Jesus said, no, 70 times 7, you know? And it wasn't so much about the number. Don't do the math. And, you know, it's that wasn't the principle. It was the principle of you continue to forgive him. Right. And so this guy, he was the one sibling out of that family who decided to forgive his dad. And I saw a picture of him like arm in arm with his dad smiling after, like, I think his dad, he led his dad to the Lord and his dad apologized. And, you know, he got beyond that. And I was like, wow, that's freaking powerful. I mean, that's pretty bad, like what your dad did to you, and for you to have that relationship and for you to have the forgiveness in your heart. And so that's his whole life mantra now. And the guy's a happy guy. He's not dead like his other brother, and he's not like strung out on drugs like the other one. And I've seen that picture so many times over. It's really amazing to watch. And those are really hard concepts to put into practice, but as somebody who's lived it, and I've had to forgive people, I don't want to get into the details because I don't even want to relive those things, but like, people have done me wrong, but you know, I found it in my heart to forgive them, and I've moved on, and I've actually restored relationships with those people. Now there's always that cautiousness that you have, like, you know, you don't fully open up the trust and so forth, but you can reestablish a relationship like that guy did with his dad. It's pretty, pretty powerful.
I do believe, I don't do it as much as I should, but I believe that forgiveness doesn't free them. It frees us. Forgiveness exactly. Isn't
you do it for you. You do it for you. You don't do it for them. They've forgotten about you. Like, they have moved on, right? Except for that guy's dad. Like, when he finally confronted him, And it doesn't always work out that way. I mean, I don't know if you've read David Goggins' books. I got kind of obsessed with his books, you know, but like, he had a dad who was pretty rough, and he tried with his dad, and I don't think it worked out, but you know what? He at least freed his heart of it. He went back and did the right thing. You can't control what the other person does. Right. I can't remember the details, but I think his dad was just a lost cause, but you know, whatever.
Yeah, he went back up to Buffalo, try to make things right, and then he realized that at the end of the day, he was just going to be who he was, and then he realized that it wasn't his job to change him, but he made peace with his demons in that respect. Exactly. As well.
Exactly. And you know, I watch, and David Goggins, as crazy as some of his stuff is, his message, you know, changed my son's life. So my son, we moved to Texas. My youngest son was really upset with me. I moved him away from his friends, and And, you know, in the middle of COVID, the COVID time sucked. And like, he was doing work, you know, school from home. He didn't have friends, and he was taking a lot out of me. He was just miserable. And he was going to let his life go kind of on that misery course. He wasn't really applying for colleges. He wasn't doing the things I really wanted him to do. It was really hard to put motivation in him. And then he got a hold of David Goggins' book. And it was a combination of David Goggins, and he started reading the Bible. And the combination of those two things completely changed him. I watched him go from somebody who sat in his room playing video games all day and was complaining and just miserable to a guy who started going to the gym. And now he's benching 250 pounds and he's like this, you know, bodybuilder. And he you know what? He got into Baylor and he's in the freaking honors college now and he's got a girlfriend and you know what? He's loving life. And now he looks back on it. Had he not moved to Texas, he wouldn't be at Baylor. He wouldn't be in the honors college and he wouldn't have the wonderful girlfriend that he has. And he's happy as can be now. And so, you know, hats off to David Goggins, as crazy as his story was, it helped a lot of people.
Absolutely. So this has been a terrific conversation. I just love these conversations, just, you know, wanting to be a student in life, being curious. I think it's always been such a beautiful thing to have because you always just want to learn things. You always want to learn where people are coming from and all their experiences and stuff like that. And so just to close out today, if you wouldn't mind, you know, sharing with where people can find your new book, a little bit about it as well, where people can connect with you outside of your book, and as well as maybe just one key takeaway that you have from today's conversation as well.
Yeah, well, you know what, Isaac, you're a very well-read guy. I admire that in you. I wish I would have done the reading that you did at a younger age, because as you get on with life, it gets busy. And I've tried to capture some of those things. I wasn't a good student of all these things when I was younger. I didn't care about this stuff, to be honest with you. But now, not only am I trying to capture that stuff and learn that stuff, I'm also espousing my own stuff. And it's not based upon necessarily other people's lives and writings. It's based upon my experiences, right? I've lived life. I've experienced what it's like to live the other way and what it's like to live the way I've lived. It's kind of half and half now. And because of that, I've got a good juxtaposition of what it's like to live without all these values and learnings, and what it is like to live like that. And so I try to capture that in my book, and it's called How to Live the Abundant Life. You can find it if you just search on How to Live the Abundant Life and you put in my name, Carl Grant III, it pops up. And it's actually hit, you know, bestseller category in some of the categories, which is kind of cool, you know, and it's gotten, so far, knock on wood, 5-star reviews, and people who have read it have come back and told me how much it's helped them. And you know what? That makes me feel good. I didn't write the book to become rich. It's like, you're not gonna get rich writing a book. It just doesn't happen that way, you know, but usually not. But if I can change people's lives, my gosh, you know, what a good thing to do. And to have people come up and thank you for it. And so if you get my book and it helps you and you like it, you know, certainly write a review, but find me. The best way to find me is on social media. I'm on LinkedIn. If you look up Carl Grant III, you'll find me and let me know that you've read my book, or if you've heard me on a podcast. You know, if you just say, I want to connect with you, I don't know. I don't know what to do with those, but if you send me a meaningful message, I will respond. Or if you follow me on Instagram and you make a comment or a note, you know, I read all those and I will respond. And so I'm carl.grant.iii on Instagram and would love to connect with you one of those ways. Those are probably the best ways to find me, rather than my inbox is so full right now that I'm probably not going to respond to emails as quickly as I should, but those are great ways to find me. And I'd love to hear from you.
Great. Thanks, Carl. And I just say to close out, I think that the most beautiful thing we can do is just, again, have these kind of collective masterminds and have great conversations. And at the end of the day, just figure out how we can, you know, put the ego aside and learn how to be better humans for ourselves, for our families, and for the world. I think that change always starts within. I think it's a beautiful thing. And I think that the more we can look to be holistic in everything that we do and just at least be intentional at the base level of all that we choose to do, the world becomes a better place because of it. So again, I want to thank you for your time. Everyone, the links will be down below, one for his book, one for his LinkedIn, so you guys can connect, see what he's posting. Again, I appreciate all of you listening. I appreciate your time. Let's close it out right. Veni, vidi, vici. I came, I saw, I conquered. That concludes today's episode of The Isaac Velez Show. If you gained any value from today, we'd be grateful if you share the episode and leave a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. If you were looking to get more involved with us, visit our website, www.isaacantoniovelez.com, and follow us on Instagram for daily content. See you in the next episode.